dear listener. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this Waru Desho podcast. We're so happy to have the pleasure of your company today. If you've listened to us before and like our show, you might be wondering how you can support us, since we won't take your money. This podcast will continue to be free, but if you'd like to show your appreciation, please consider leaving us a rating and review on iTunes, as those help our discoverability. If you don't use iTunes, that's fine too. You can follow us and like and share our content on SoundCloud, YouTube, and Twitter. Additionally, we love getting your feedback, positive or negative. Tweet us at WaruiDesho or email us at waruidesho@gmail.com. Whether or not it gets read on the show, I can assure you, we all read every tweet and email you send us. And once again, dear listener, we thank you so much. Now please, enjoy the show.
Good evening, ladies, gentlemen, and MBs. Welcome to Waru Desho Stream of Thought, Episode 13, Season 3, Banana Fish, Season 1, Episode... There. You get the point. We've been on break, so excuse me for being a bit rough around the edges with the intro there. But anyway, here to put me back on track, you know, for the journey ahead is none other, of course, than the Soul Doctor.
Hello, everybody. Greetings. I don't know if I'll put you on track or push you farther off. I also... was like, wait a minute, how do I turn the stream on again? For a minute there.
Well, you know, if anyone needs a good conductor, Doc, it's you.
Is that a joke, like an electrical joke?
It's a train joke, because there's going to be plenty of those today. Listen, when we, you know, talk about the train.
Yeah, trains are...
Oh, yes.
I was discussing this with... this not the point that you're making, but the point I'm about to make with Mark from Oh No Anime at Vermillionaire. He's a super cool guy. We were talking about the strangely huge amount of electronic music that's about trains. So I have a lot of that slotted away if anybody among us needs to step away from the camera for a moment. I've got some trained theme techno on deck. No.
Is it off the rails? It's going to be like that for the rest of the stream, folks. I am so sorry. Doc is actually very grateful that he didn't drink then, because I get the feeling that it would probably have fallen over your camera. I'm so sorry. I am, by the way, drinking a Hopcock. So cheers. All right. So, first off then, I think, do we want to firstly address the Twitter polls from previous, or do we want to dive right into the episode?
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk about...
Twitter poll.
The Twitter polls. What were the polls from last time? Allow me to scroll down. Let's see, there's Dick of the Goblins joke. Scrolling past that.
Classic. Okay. Classic.
Indeed. All right. Here are our polls from the last time we did the show. Mm-hmm. Date that I honestly don't remember.
Lots happened. I've been places, seen things.
Yes, seen things.
Had talks with people who didn't know, you know, what they were talking about when it came to certain shows.
Yuri on Ice, perhaps.
Yeah. Oh God, I'll honestly just link the video at some point. It's me admittedly kind of half drunk, but I'm also basically telling people, A, you know what, romance between whoever is great. B, for fighting game players, you might want to appreciate Yuri on Ice for the fact that it's about kindling passion, you know, what makes a competitive sport interesting and engaging with people and why it matters such. So maybe that might be a little relevant to you? Possibly? I don't know. Just chucking that out there. Hadoxa, you may wish to crank your volume up tiny bits.
Oh, am I low? Okay, let me take care
of it. You're low, so bring it high, my friend. Bring it up.
All right, let's see what I can do. How's that? Better?
Let's know, Emily. Emily's saying in chat that you are sounding on a bit such on the quiet side.
Okay. Let me see if there are other things I can do.
You need a new station for your mic. There you go.
Possibly. I don't know if I can turn myself up in Discord. Or not. Now, if I do that, it's just gonna like show weird shit on the stream instead of my
what are you up to, man? Honestly. All right. Anyway, so back to the Twitter polls. What we got?
Okay. The polls. We have. Let's see. Is the Ash/Max son/daddy thing getting weird? 69, very nice.
Nice. Percent,
say, shut up, prude. 21% say a little bit. 10% say very weird. Have you heard the phrase potato budget before? I can't remember who, like, deployed that.
Probably Macy.
Like, it was... It was very... Okay, I've turned up my volume in the... I've turned up my mic in... Why can't I make words? What is happening? OBS! So potato budget. Someone used this term, this phrase in chat, and I was like, what? What does that mean?
Oh, you're right, it was chat, it wasn't me, sorry.
No, it was not you. But... 57% say no, they've never heard it before. So I was on the side of science.
Sounds to me like they're mashing a lot of words together.
It's a fun phrase. I just had never heard it before.
Sorry, I'm throwing out all the puns today. All of them.
So are Ash's gang war methods necessary for accomplishing his purposes? So this was sort of a, like, I guess a utilitarian sort of question. And 61% say, do what must be done. Yes, they are necessary. His scorched earth policy of taking it to Arthur's guys and just completely laying them to waste, murdering guilty and,
you know,
like, is necessary.
You know, in light of episode 13, I have to say, like, if you wanted to say no, they were not necessary. And whites make the argument, not because of morals or ethics, but just because Arthur's men were completely and utterly useless. That would work as well. Mm-hmm. Because, holy shit, this episode was... Well, I'll just come out and say it. It was good. But it was also pretty weak in places. And, well, if you watch the viewer count there... Well, that's going to go to... Yeah. Sorry. Just telling us to see it.
Soundboard, you've been booed by the wave file.
Well, clearly, what you need to do next, Doc, is you need to make it so that your audio comes out of the left earphone, mine comes out of the right, and that way people can mute one of the channels. That way, they only ever hear you speak if ever I start talking.
Right.
So, place a like this episode, those people.
You'll be the devil on their shoulder or their left ear. Either way. So, okay, those are our polls. Please continue to vote in them, and also to say fun things in chat that make us think of them, or suggest them outright.
Hell yeah, keep them coming. Alright, so let's talk about episode 13, The Snows of Kilimanjaro, which it's happened all the other times before, I don't know it, but I'm willing to bet you it's a novel.
I mean, oh, Ash said as much. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That was, like, that we actually, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got the whole thing here actually outright referenced.
Was that a I didn't bother to Google it. I'm going to Google it now. I'm going to guess it's a Hemingway story.
That sounds like it could be right.
Any other guesses on your part before I press enter?
No, I'm going with Hemingway on that one.
I would make Hemingway the odds-on favorite with.
Yeah, he's a well-traveled man. Yep.
It's a short story by Ernest Hemingway. I was gonna. I think at this point you have to put F. Scott Fitzgerald on the board as a bet, even if Fitzgerald doesn't have the best odds, just because, you know, he's been.
You should make a bingo card out of these literary references.
I know.
You know, we'll have a full house by the end of this. All right. Anyway, speaking of house, that is, let's talk about the episode. So the episode opens with a brief flashback before, you know, the ending of the previous episode when Ash left off into the night to go finally kill his one true nemesis, Dio. I, of course, mean Arthur.
Trashy Super Saiyan himself.
Yeah, pretty much. Not the last Dio reference I'm going to make, but yeah. So Ash gives instructions to his two flunkies saying, right, okay, here's how this is going to happen. I'm going to go down there and I'm going to kill the fuck out of Arthur. In the meantime, you ask to get Ash out of the country via the plane that I have booked for him. And, you know, they ask him, oh, he's going to hate you for all of this, surely? And he's like, yeah, that's the point. I don't want to, you know, leave a lingering attachment there. I want to, you know, get rid of it for age's sake. The old, you know, I'm pushing you away because I don't want you to be close to thing, even though ideally he would. All seems. Anyway. He's not the only one brooding, though, because, of course, now he turns everyone's favourite sock puppet, Arthur himself, who's just, you know, enjoying his time getting ready. Yeah. Because he's limp and useless.
He's a sock puppet. What else could we... What else is, you know... We have to... I feel like this is the episode where we have to exhaust all of our references.
So, yeah, he's currently brooding, you know, in a bedroom somewhere, thinking about the time that he and Ash actually fought. Specifically, he's looking at his fingers. And he reminds himself of the fight in which he lost to Ash and then tried to kill him with a gunshot to the back. Ash, you know, because, well, he taps into the Matrix, dodged the bullet, got in close, and then cut Arthur's fingers off. So that's how it happened. Ash, by the way, also, when I say the Matrix, like the roundhouse kick in the judo throw he pulls off here. Like, I'm very sorry to say, like, I really do like Ash as a character, but this... Some bits of this show are starting to go a bit extreme on just how good he is at combat. And this is not the last time I'll mention this when we get to later parts of the episode, once, you know, the fight actually does start.
Yeah, we'll talk about this coming up. But, this is the one where, I mean...
Credulity is strained.
Yeah, they've done a good job so far, relatively speaking good, at sort of striking a balance between Ash being this sort of feared devil, you know, gunman with a reputation of like being able to take out just about anybody and having that be his reputation, but it like not putting him in these situations where he has to be like Nathan Drake and just slaughter waves and waves and waves.
That is the best comparison I could think, like.
You know,
like the phrase cover shoots mechanics came to mind a couple of times during.
But he's just out in the open sometimes, and these kids are just like worse than stormtroopers with their aim or fumbling their guns. I don't know. I'm getting into it now, but yeah, they haven't put him in too many. Like, there's been a couple situations, of course, where he's faced more than one person, but they were in corridors and he was heavily armed or had. Backup, or I don't know, the situation just seems slightly more believable. Like, it's like, okay, like, he's Rambo, but like, it's a believable Rambo. It's not like he's just fucking walking up to an army, you know, it's not some Dragon Ball shit, you know, where he's like catching bullets and throwing them, you know, which it wasn't exactly that here, but boy, it got a little bit.
Yeah. All right, anyway, so back on track. After the OP, Arthur arrives at the meeting place where Cade is waiting for it. You know, reminds him, no tricks, one-on-one, and my God, Cade is a gullible bastard. I mean...
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus Christ, like, I know that, like, you know, Ash kind of wowed him with his, you know, big brass balls thing in the previous episode. But I genuinely, at this point, think Kane is probably not really that good at anything. Like, aww. Honestly.
He's good at looking imposing and intimidating.
Oh, congratulations, and he can be a shot front mannequin for all I care. Whoop-de-fuck-a-dee-doo. Like, you know. Ugh. Anyway, moving on.
He's good at having a sort of cool nickname in a show with some questionable nicknames.
Well, you know, he just needs a henchman who's called a bell, and then we're all set. Well, actually, no, there's a reason he doesn't, because he's already killed him.
Hey-o, yep. Yep.
There you go. All right, so they arrive at the subway, which has been disused, and, you know, men are watching all the other exits. Kane's men
specific. His henchmen suck. Let me put that out.
Every henchman sucks ever. Like, all of them. Perpetually. Know, whenever... They're all shit.
So Singh just wanders in, and he's like, I've had my people clean the place out. And it's like, okay. Sure,
oh, don't.
That's one
thing.
And then they start crawling out of the trash can.
I literally thought someone was going to fall out of a roof tile by accident. Like, who else was going to turn up next? Were we going to start having, you know, like, the baseball furies turn up?
Oh, bye-bye, Lucy.
Were D12 going to turn up with Eminem in tow? Catch you later, Lucy.
Yeah. What if someone was just going to step out?
This was turning into this
from behind Kane.
This
I've been behind you.
This bit was turning into the scene from Anchorman, where they have the fight. Like, you know, you start off the two, and then suddenly it's just more and more and more and more.
I love that scene.
I'm surprised Ben Stiller with his fake, you know, faux Spanish accent didn't turn up and say Spanish language is here to watch Ash Lynx get his ass kicked.
But, okay, in the defense of the show, I want to say that I feel like we sort of should have expected this. I feel like it's you know, for a little while, it's been...
Oh, I totally knew that Arthur was going to, you know, not... He wasn't going to be straight with this. He was, of course, going to be a bent bastard.
Well, that is, yes. But, I mean, just the silliness of, like, people pouring out of, like, manhole covers... Like a train coming in and like the gunfight in the train. But before all that stuff, this episode, I don't know. I mean, Ash did discover a hidden armory and like, you know, go through a mansion, like wearing a couple of like bandoliers and had an automatic machine gun in each hand. Like, I feel like, I don't know, maybe you should have seen it coming that the plot wasn't necessarily going for like,
realism.
I mean, it's going for gritty feelings and like dark feelings and dealing with real issues, but maybe, I don't know, they did drive a fucking semi truck into the bad guy's hideout and just come out.
I do have to say, like, on the one hand, I actually do want to give Arthur credit for pulling off the most ambitious drive-by ever. I mean, who's done a drive-by using a subway train? That's impressive. That's really something. But I also like to imagine in an alternate version. I like to imagine in an alternate version of this show, like, they had an outtake. Like, all of his men get on that train and they go to the completely wrong station. There's just some hobo there reading a newspaper. Like, I hadn't seen a train stopping here in months. And they're like, fuck, boss, do we do? I'll just go to the next one. We'll get there eventually.
We accidentally took the L train.
Oh, shit.
The wrong line. That reminded me, that was some, like, I don't know, Streets of Rage shit right there, Final Fight.
You're right.
Wall guns. So they took their own graffiti-covered train. Like, something about the aesthetics of it was really appealing. Just a rogue, graffiti-covered train, like, full of, you know, Uzi-toting thugs dressed up, you know, like they're in Fatal Fury or Streets of Rage.
To be fair, Arthur is so pathetic, I'm literally stunned that rather than a train, it wasn't just like one of those like little car things that have two people like winding a lever back and forth. Mm-hmm. Like, I literally thought it was going to be like, you just hear it, like, you just hear it coming from miles away.
The Wile E. Coyote, like.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. The Bugs Bunny shit right there. All right, so back on track. Sorry.
Emily asked a good question. Like, or raises a good point, rather. Like, How did Arthur get this train? I mean, we know
if
that
it was,
Golzine has connections.
Yes, yes. If it was Golzine, I'd have bought it.
But how can they...
I'm surprised Arthur is intelligent enough to understand how to use the subway, never mind actually buy and run a train down it.
Yeah, I mean, how did they get a train and shut down a... I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just as uncomplicated as, you know, they have some decision maker on their payroll, and they shut down a part of the subway for cleaning that day or something.
I will be fair and say that before Golzine left, he did give all of his operations over to Arthur, so he could very well have the connections through them.
Who is just burning alliances left and right. what a fucking idiot. All the way to the end.
I know. All right, so anyway, yes, the pair of them do arrive. Ash arrives at the subway. They go down to, you know, the station, the stall area. Su Ling is waiting for them. One thing I want to mention, actually, very briefly, I haven't brought before about Su Ling, is that I've noticed that his jacket has a monkey on it. Again, you're continuing the animal motif there with the various characters. Just a small aside. So Su Ling, you know, he he says he wants to stay and watch, and I'm like, okay, fair enough. And then he says, all right, after Kane, that is, says, all right, gentlemen, do I have you two have any disagreement? Ash's like, nah. And Arthur's like, I refuse. And I'm like, Su Ling then just starts taking the piss out of, and I'm like, even the show at this point thinks Arthur is useless.
Yeah.
And that's kids that is fun. That, I mean, Su Ling is barely old enough to ride the teacups at Disneyland, and he's still taking the piss out of this guy.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing, right? I want you to put a pin in that for later, because... we'll spoil it because we're going to spoil it anyway. Arthur is 90% certain to be dead at the end of this episode. I am fairly confident. So we're going to have a bit of... we're still going to do a post-mortem quote-unquote on this. That was pretty bad, I'm sorry. But yeah, we're going to talk about Arthur as a character at the end of this. Here's the problem. I don't mind making a laugh and a joke about Arthur as a character, and I'll go into this in more detail later once we summarise the plot. But there's a point in which I think that, unfortunately, it went a bit too far, and now even the show's getting on it, and this kind of just... Anyway, I'll save that.
Do you think he needs credibility, in some sense? At least as within the organization, or...
He needed to feel like an actual threat. That's why I'll say now, but I'll save the discussion for that for later.
Okay,
so... they do indeed, you know, get ready to start throwing down. No guns, they hand over the guns, that's all solid. Like, Arthur says, I didn't bring one, blah, 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 blah. And then, of course, you know, Arthur's midnight train, you know, the Ozzy Osbourne Crazy Train song, like, arrives, shooting all the Uzis everywhere. Kane's men, because they're idiots, like, they hear gunfire and they think to themselves, all right, what are we going to do? We're going to run down the stairs and get mowed down.
They have to Congratulations. Protect their boss, though. They have to protect their boss. Come on.
Look, I know that Operation Bullet Sponge is a thing, but it's not a viable strategy. Like, holy shit, honestly. Everyone who's basically not Ash and maybe AG are idiots in this episode. It's a bit ridiculous. So yeah, that happens, and all of the various guys start pouring out the train. Su Ling passes, you know, Ash's gun to Kane, who then gets his Ash. And at this point, every single one of Arthur's men forgets how guns work, or cover, or common sense. That all completely evaporates the moment Ash gets hold of his revolver, and he starts murdering the fuck out of everyone. And so more and more people, of course, start pouring out. At this point, you know, Su Ling's guys show up, and they start killing people, and then Kane's guys show up.
They, like, materialize from thin air.
Yeah. I'm surprised there wasn't a smoke cloud.
Speaking of Bugs Bunny, it's like one of those situations where you have like the skinniest pole in the world that no one can ever fit behind, and then whoop, someone is revealed to have been behind it. Like they're just coming out of like these tiny crevices in the floor and stuff.
Pretty much, yeah. All right. So in all this chaos and confusion, Ash actually does manage to get on board the train as it departs, because Arthur decides, you know, well, I'm going to do the Monty Python and run away, live another day.
It was a Max Payne style dive and roll.
Oh, the Max Payne references. I'm so genuinely surprised. Like, I could put Max Payne quotes over this in Ash's voice, and it would fit so much of it. It's kind of ridiculous. But yeah, train gets away, Ash is on board. And, you know, this is the point where things start Well, I was always going to make an off the rails joke then, but oh, fuck yeah, I will. Things do go off the rails here a little bit narratively. But before we get to that, of course, AG wakes up. He goes outside, tries to leave, and of course, Ash's Souflunky stop him. Says, yeah, no, you gotta wait here, then we're gonna take you to the airport. He says, can I have a little bit of a rest? And he does, you know, get some kip. It's a bit later, actually. So yeah, he's like thinking to himself, like, Ash, where have you been? What are you doing? Like, what kind of person are you? He said, the stuff with him. Meanwhile, back on the train to Mementos, because that's where they're ending up right now. I mean, can you just imagine that? Like, you've got, you know, Mona and all the various Phantom Thieves in the car, and that train goes past. They're like, hey, what's that? Nothing. It's fine. Ignore it. It's fine. It's fine.
Just keep going.
So anyway.
Just keep going.
So anyway. Open questions, people in the chat. Have you ever seen the movie Hot Shots Part 2 or 2? It's a Rambo parody.
I have. It's been fucking decades.
So it's probably older than some of the people in this chat, to be honest, because it's an old film.
But yeah, it's one of them is a Top Gun parody, and one of them is a Rambo. Or they just kind of mix and match, like, whatever.
All right.
They're just parodying various action movies, right?
Yeah. So here's the thing about this movie, right? There's a scene in it in which there's a massive gunfight, in which I think it's Charlie Sheen's character, starts gunning down people with an M60. And the joke then is they have a kill counter on the bottom, which then starts flashing up titles like bloodiest, like more kills than Terminator 2, more kills than Die Hard, etc., etc., right, culminating in bloodiest action movie ever made. And as this whole train scene went on, that was the idea I thought of. That was the
Ding.
Thing that came to mind.
Ding.
Here's the thing, right? Yeah, I know. It was getting a bit unreal tournament. I mean, you mentioned Nathan Drake before. It literally felt like cover shooting mechanics. I'm honestly surprised that when Ash gets shot later that he didn't crouch behind cover and have that wound just magically heal itself.
Why did the camera not go, like, the shot should have turned black and white and the background
it should have film burn
out,
on
and
it.
Then, like, only have, like, a heartbeat in our ear.
Yeah. You're hurt. Get to cover.
Like, I'm, like, making a lot of jokes because I think they're funny, and it sounds like I'm way more critical of the show for all this than I actually do feel in my heart. Like,
I am gonna be critical a bit.
Okay, I know.
Sorry
to
say,
I don't mind it as much. I'm fine with a little bit of the board in this area.
I'll save my reason on that for the end again. But anyway, yeah. Like, Arthur learns that Ash is on the train, and he says, "Right, it's okay. We're good." He's in the middle car-ish, like six car, I think it is. So we'll get the guys at the rear and the guys at the front to just, you know, pizza moving. Not a bad strategy, except for the fact that, once again, as before, Arthur's men could not hit water if they fell out of a boat. You think I'm joking? They literally pin Ash down the car. They have him dead middle. He has nowhere to hide. He cannot shoot all of them at the same time because he only has a revolver, which, by the way, he somehow has unlimited ammo for and never reloads, which I was quite impressed by.
That was the one. I was like, wow. this is something.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously, he put in the cheat code. Like, where's he getting the bullets?
Honestly, I'm surprised he didn't have no clip on. Just fade out of the car and then just move on to a different one. So, yeah, why? Like, they do get a hit on him eventually. But even that, to me, feels trivial for him saying that for later. Put a pin in it. So, of course, Ash is just mowing his way through all the various goons. It's not going particularly well for any of them. We then, at some point, you know, I think AG, like, tries to leave again. We then get the flashback, which is probably the episode's most interesting moment. This is one which we haven't seen before, in which Ash and AG are on the waterfront in New York somewhere, and they're discussing, Ash specifically brings up the topic of death. He says, how do you feel about death? And he mentions the title of the episode, which is, of course, The Snows of Kilimanjaro, and specifically the tale of a leopard?
It was a leopard, wasn't it?
A leopard carcass they found at the top of Kilimanjaro's peak, which was frozen there. And he's like, okay, why did the leopard get there? How did it end up there? What was the reasoning it for ending up there? It's, you know, doesn't make sense. And he identifies with that as, like, you know, almost being like how he feels he's going to die. And he offers some reasoning behind this, like, or specifically offers reasoning why the leopard did it. Like, was it chasing prey? Got lost? Was it trying to come back down from the mouse and ultimately couldn't make it? So yeah, for two reasons. I have a third theory that he doesn't mention, but I will get to that at the end as well. My talking, so pop it in that as well.
Involve aliens.
Sadly, like, no. Oh man, can you imagine? Can you imagine Ash versus the Xenomorph?
I need that in my life.
He would do pretty well.
He would. He is, I would say he might be more talented than Ripley. You know, if you give.
Well, I was going to say if Ash was a Marine in Aliens, the second one, the movie would be over in 40 minutes because he would be the only one not to lose his shit, and he would deal with them all.
Would Arthur be in Aliens? Would he be?
Oh, he would be the spineless. He would be the spineless Weyland Yutani corporate guy.
Oh, so he would be that guy.
He would be the spineless twat, basically.
Who's Bill Paxton? Is that
Bill Paxton was one of the Marines?
Is eBay Bill Paxton?
But no, he's Max.
Game
Max.
Over, man. the overly cautious one.
Yeah, indeed. So that's the tale that he relates anyway, specifically of the leopard's carcass and what it means to him as, like, you know, where his life is and where he's going to end up. And as I say, he offers two ideas, like, but I have a different interpretation, which I'll save. So anyway, after that, AJ manages to slip, you know, his flunkies, gets slipped down. He mentions another scene which we haven't seen previously, in which Ash was, like, you know, weeping in his sleep, you know, crying out for his mother. AG says he ignored it, but he's like, again, pondering, you know, what this could mean, like, you know, how tortured is Ash as a person, like, that kind of stuff. Anyway, back to the train car of death, and, well, one of Arthur's goons is so pathetic he just gives up and just falls to the floor to be shot. I mean, I suppose I should credit the guy at least for thinking to himself, you know, I know I'm going to die, so I might as well just make it quick. I mean, I'm not getting off this train car alive. So, hey. But anyway, the cops are being rallied to the end of Death Station, the end of the line, literally, for Arthur, as it turns out, later, which I thought was a nice little, even if perhaps Velma knows, I thought it was a nice bit of metaphor there. Go on.
Refresh my memory of how the cops were made aware of this in the first place.
They were tracking the subway system. I think,
Why?
I don't know. Something must have sparked their interest to keep an eye out for it.
Okay.
That's how they know they're going to Coney Island anyway.
Right. That's where the line is.
Speaking of which, Coney Island, Warriors reference.
Yes.
I made that joke enough times now, but I'm actually convinced that the person who wrote Banana Fish originally must have seen the Warriors. Although someone will probably point out to me now that it was out after Fish, because I can't remember the exact year. But anyway.
Whatever influenced the Warriors, maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's a calculus situation. You know what I mean? Two people without knowledge of one another both invent calculus at the same time, or maybe slightly different times, but around the same time in different places. Maybe that's the
for sure. For sure. So yeah, they're you know, on route to Coney Island, and of course, Ash eventually does catch up to Arthur. Arthur's like, "Well, you've got me. Go on, blow me the fuck away." And Ash, sportingly as he is, mirrors explained that there were scenes in the manga that established them looking for him, and then they, well, didn't show that, so...
Yeah, but, well, like, I guess, like, you know, if you have people doing their job monitoring activity of the subway systems, it probably would not have been... It wouldn't have taken too much to see that there was... something amiss on this line that's meant to be shut down.
Why is there a train going to the closed platform at this time of night? Shut up. I don't pay you to talk.
Go to sleep. That's what you're supposed to do.
Something like that. But yeah, Ash being very sportsmanlike, you know, drops his guns as his side and says, right, we're going to have this fucking fight that you walks away from. My reaction to this initially was, no, just fucking shoot him. He clearly doesn't want to play by the rules. Why? What do you have to lose by doing this? Just, again, another problem I have with this episode is that unfortunately Ash decides to be very, you know, sportsmanlike to Arthur when There's nothing riding on him doing that because Arthur has violated the rules. You know, they laid it down. As far as I'm concerned, he should have plugged in full of lead there and then and tossed him out the door.
Yeah, I have a lot of, like, I have a lot of thoughts that I want to try to untangle about this scene. When we are into our talking points. But but yeah, like, it didn't end up sitting well with me. I wanted the payoff for this to be a lot more satisfying than it ended up being.
I have a theory on why that is, actually.
This is by design or whatever, but
I have a theory on why that is, but we'll get to that in a bit. So yeah, end of the line. By the way, while this is happening, AG has actually been picked up by the Flunkies again, who are now, I believe, going to take him to Ash. They decide, fuck it, we'll take you there. They know what's going down. I do have to wonder, though, actually, come to think of it, although again,
anymore. He has a right to know.
Maybe this is me not paying attention. If I'm not, then I confess that's the case. But how did they know they had relocated to Coney Island? Because they knew where the duel was initially. Was on the news? I don't know. It ultimately doesn't matter. I'm not really that fussed by it. It's just something that just occurs.
I don't remember. But like, as much as we like to joke about small details, it probably, you know, it ultimately doesn't matter too much to
effectiveness. I don't know. Maybe you know, they just thought they'd go there for a Pokemon Go gym for all that matters. Like, it's on the way. Why not? Look, I'm gonna go get me a Mew. Why not?
Look at all these people standing here. Surely this is like a Pokestop. Let's go over there.
Absolutely.
Wait a minute. It's a knife fight. Oh, it's Ash. What a lucky coincidence.
There we go. Mirror explained it was on the news. So there we go. I just missed that. See, this is why I'm glad that you know, I have someone around, people around who, like, you know what they're talking about, as opposed to me running his mouth. All right, so the fight that we've seen, the OP, actually now does kick off, and Ash is at a disadvantage because he has actually still been shot in the arm. So the fight is actually pretty good. I rather liked how it played out visually. I thought it was quite impressive.
Yeah, none of my beliefs are with that.
Yeah, AG arrives, yells out Ash's name, and the moment he did that, I was just like, why? Why?
Why?
You absolute clown, because he's busy. Like, you shouldn't be yelling his name. Like, I seriously get the impression that, if Ash was on the toilet, AG would barge in like, Ash, I need your help! Like, fuck's sake. So, of course, that distraction means that, you know, Arthur gets a blow on him, gets to cut him up. But, you know, the fight progresses, and eventually Ash does overpower him and cuts Arthur up real fucking good. Stabs him even. Cuts his neck open. So he is, I want to say he's dead, but the cynic in me says no, because we don't get that explicitly, objectively confirmed on screen. We just see him fall, go splat. And if there's one thing I know about Arthur is that he's a stubborn bastard, but that's all he's really got going for him. Honest, like, 90-10 odds, he's dead. So we'll go with that. We'll just say
he
is.
How can he live?
How can people materialize out of subways?
It was a Mortal Kombat 2 style fatality. Just like the blood spray from Arthur as the knife got pulled out of him in like an arc. It was picturesque.
It was picturesque. I was happy to see that.
If he lived after that, like, elaborately filmed.
I was this like, yeah, that'll do. Finally. It was like the tides turning in. It was inevitable. Glad we fucking got to see it. Unfortunately, however, because this is also technically kind of Grand Theft Auto-esque, wanted levels cranks up to max. All the cops turn up. Every single cop everywhere. And everyone gets arrested, save for Ash's flunkies, who managed to slip away. And that's pretty much the episode. Ash, like, collapses because of all the blood loss and strain he's been under. That's it, pretty much. Yeah, Arthur is done. So I said before, like, that I weren't entirely sure he's dead, but I'm going to take that back. He definitely is, because his narrative purpose is exhausted at this point. We still have other antagonists apart from Galzine there. We, of course, have, you know, Dark Side of the Moon himself, Lot Young, floating around somewhere.
Totally absent this episode.
Yeah, we've got Su Ling as well. He's around. And, of course, we've got, you know, final boss, Disc 4 final boss Golzine himself. So, but insofar as Arthur's purpose goes, he's done. He's spent. Having him back at this point would be a waste anyway, so I'm not going to worry about his return. Good riddance to bad rubbish anyway. So yeah, that was episode 13, The Snows of Kilimanjaro. Alright, who wants to talk talking points?
Well, before we do that, we're going to have to take a break.
Dun, 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 dun.
Sorry, folks. I need to step away for a few moments, but we will be back. And yeah, to get to our in-depth discussion of the nitty-gritty this episode. So,
yeah.
BRB.
So we'll be back on track shortly. No? No? Sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm not really, fuck that.
We'll be right back.
Hello, everyone. All right, so let us get into this Occupy Spot episode 13. Do you want to go first, Doc, or shall I?
Well, I want to do the sounder first.
Talking points.
Now we're okay to begin.
Do you want me to start speaking fire, or do you want me to, like...
No, I can go first, because... I feel like you've done most of the talking, so I'll give you a break.
Yeah, I'll.
Well, just, you know, we've talked a lot about, well, maybe not a lot about, but I think we both feel like that the scene in the middle of the episode, the flashback scene, the scene which, you know, Eiji's thinking about things in his room at night, is the best part of the episode. Is certainly,
yes.
I feel like, the most powerful part.
And, easily. So
there's a few thoughts I have about this scene. The first one, the least kind of deep, dark, and or philosophical, is that, you know, during the flashback Eiji has, Ash is saying, hey... There's this Ernest Hemingway novel, The Snows of Kilimanjaro. Here's what happens. Here's how I feel like sort of that story sees me. You know, here's how I feel like a character in that story, or that story speaks to me. And in certain circumstances, right, I can see people say, like, taking this to task. Like, a lot of, so I just want to talk about, like, media that's referential to other media, because so anime in particular as a medium gets a lot of stick for this, for particularly being self-referential, and saying, well, there's all kinds of anime that reference other anime because anime creators are in this bubble where they're big fans and only watch this kind of anime, and so you also have to be a fan, and it's kind of alienating if you're not a fan, and on, and you know, we use phrases in other contexts besides anime as well, talking about things being on the nose. And in a certain sort of way, I could see someone saying, well, gosh, this reference is not only on the nose, but they take great pains to point out to you, here's how The Snows of Kilimanjaro relates to this story, this character in this episode.
Yeah.
It's all... I can understand where that comes from. But I think I just wanted to make the point that here in this case, I'm completely fine with it, because first of all, it is anime that, and it's an adaptation, so it's not an anime original. It's just a very old property as well, coming from a time before a lot of people were accusing the anime industry of being so, you know, circularly self-referential in its material. This is like a manga referencing an older book. And quite frankly, like, a lot of people that see this episode of anime or read this manga, There's probably a good chance they haven't read The Snows of Kilimanjaro and know what it's about.
I said, yeah, got me there.
Yeah, I mean, I consider myself well-read, but no, I've read other Hemingway. You know, I've read A Farewell to Arms. I've read Old Man and the Sea.
Man, does that mean if Banana Fish were a video game, you'd get an achievement for having read all the books?
Yes. Yeah, this is that. This is totally that. Read every piece of paper. Read all the Street Fighter combos and gone home. Achievement unlocked. Did you get a trophy for that? For reading everything and gone home? There was a lot to read in that game. I feel like you probably should have. Anyway. Boy, I was totally, like, completely fine with it. Like, this kind of reference to something very old, I think is cool and good and can make you want to seek out the other material. Because, I mean, it certainly piqued my interest. I feel like, goodness, well, that's an interesting sort of tale. Like, I wonder what questions Hemingway himself raises about this. And so I think there's ways to do reference in media. And I know the timeliness of the reference can have a lot to, can bring a lot to the table in terms of like how you do it. You know, if you're referencing popular culture versus, or like timely culture versus, you know, classic novel, like it just kind of can dictate like the rules and what's acceptable to do and what makes sense. So I thought that was fine here. And it just got me thinking like, about referential media, because like I said, anime is very referential, and it made me want to like kind of analyze more deeply how different anime do it, especially when it comes to referencing other media.
I hear you. For me, I think firstly the idea, you know, of an all or nothing, you know, it's referential because it's anime, like that's rubbish. It's a case by case basis, as it is with everything. Like, Christ, you know, by that logic, all anime is, you know, tentacle shit, because that's the perception that people have, even though that's patently false. For me, when it comes to references like this, I think there are two criteria that it needs to meet in order to be used well. The first of which is, if you don't get the reference because you've not read it or seen it, the show should still work, regardless of. So, yes, this does give us an insight into how Ash feels about his potential future. But we've had a lot of insight prior to this point into his character that wasn't dependent on literary references. So if you don't know about the Snows of Kilimanjaro, A, firstly, explains it, of course, but B, it's not entirely necessary to understand his character. It's another puzzle piece that we get given. It's just one that unfortunately comes through the lens of fiction. But again, we have an explanation for it. And two, which ties into that, is that it's pertinent to his character. He's not bringing this up to look smart. He brings this up because it's relevant to who he is, and he's obviously thought about it. Like, you know, he's identified with it. I can speak to books that I have on my shelf just over it off camera there, some of which I very strongly identify with. I mean, I've been reading Land of the Lustrous, the manga recently, and there's a particular thing in Volume 7 that's just like, well, that's me to a T. I get that entirely. I felt that way. So I don't think it's unreasonable in this scenario for it to happen. But I would absolutely agree with people who would look at an individual work and say, this is just literally a guy quoting shit for no good reason. Like, if you had, like, let's say, you know, what, harem anime in which the guy constantly quotes Salinger for no reason other than because he's a smartass, I would probably find that incredibly grating very quickly.
Yeah, you've reminded me. What show is it in?
I was thinking of that. I was like, I'm sure I've heard that before, but I thought I'd make a more generic example.
Yeah, I think it's, this is not a harem anime, but there's an anime from around the turn of the millennium called Stelvia of the Universe, and it's basically like Harry Potter, only instead of becoming witches or wizards, like, you are becoming a space pilot. And there is a...
Oh, it's the saucy helmet then, that's right. You put it on, it speaks to you in the...
Right, the sorting helmet. Yeah.
By the way, if you want my hot, quick take on Harry Potter, generally speaking, it's crap. Just thought I'd throw that out there.
Well,
I mean,
it certainly hasn't aged especially well.
It wasn't good at the time it was released, to be quite honest. I'm going to be blunt with you here. Well, when I say that, there were bits that were good. Specifically, not to do with any of the main characters, or specifically anyone under the age of 18.
Right.
All of the young characters, it was shite. But anyway, that's a discussion for a different time.
The reason I bring up Stelvia is just because there's a character in it that always quotes Shakespeare. She just...
Yeah. You know,
and that's her sort of... That's her checkbox character trait, because we don't really get to spend a lot of time with her. So we know that she's very sort of, like, somber, always, like, looking rather dour and down, and has a voice that's very, you know, I'm coming from a dark place. So saith Shakespeare. And like, yeah, she's always quoting Shakespeare.
Yeah, and besides, if you want to start explaining the anime is that way, there's tons of Western media that does that as well. Best Star Trek movie ever made, Wrath of Khan. Like, literally one of the shots of it is of Chekhov looking at a list of books that Khan has read, including Paradise Lost and Moby Dick, which of course are the very on-the-nose, you know, oh, it's vengeance. Vengeance is the thing going on here. But that's fine. That works in the actual context of the thing. It's on a case-by-case basis. You can't paint everything with the same brush just because some stuff has been, you know, self-referential in a way that's honestly quite draining. Fuck's sake, honestly.
Yeah.
I really hate generalizations like that. They annoy me. Right.
All right.
I'll actually know...
Next point.
All right. I'm going to actually segue from what you said and talk about my interpretation of the Kilimanjaro flashback. Okay. So just to recount, and if I am misrepresenting or misremembering, please, of course, correct me on this. Ash offers two interpretations of what happened to the cougar. Leopard, sorry. Glad I managed to stop myself.
Who can really do... Why did that just cop in? Do you remember the song from Home Alone 2?
I don't remember Home Alone 2, period.
Come on. We're...
Hey, okay, so the two
God damn it. Oh, you've tickled me now that I've thought of this cougar song Home Alone 2.
Alright, so two interpretations of this. Mm-hmm. One, the cougar got lost going up there, or it was trying to leave and couldn't get away. And it died as a result. Was that what Ash said? I just want to make this clear before I start talking about my interpretation that he may or may not realize. Not because he's in it, because, you know, sometimes you don't six as you're in that snap. That's what the cougar said. Leopard.
What I've got down is that, you know, the leopard could have been searching for prey. The leopard could have been scaling the mountain for some, you know, sort of almost human reasons, I guess, wanting to conquer it. Or maybe it, in its journey, crossed some point of no return and couldn't find its way back to where it was supposed to be.
Okay. Right. Third interpretation. Roll with me on this. What if the leopard was brought there against its will? Here's the thing, right? That environment, of course, that Kilimanjaro place, the top of it, is no place for any living thing, really. Living things, of course, have their environments that they are designed to live in. So imagine if that leopard was taken there as a pet, for example, dragged up there forcefully for whatever reason, because people thought it would be fucking funny. Would that not be analogous to what's happened to Ash? He was someone who was clearly taken out of his natural environment against his will, you know, and left to wander this kind of like wasteland and try to get away from it, couldn't ultimately do so.
Mm-hmm.
That's my interpretation of what might have happened instead and why it's actually analogous to his plight then. That he, you know, through no fault of his own, unfortunately, ended up on said mountain, the mountain that is his current life, the wasteland that is his current life. So that, to me, is the alternative interpretation I would offer. Other thing as well to think of, what happens when you get lost on a mountain? You usually need someone to guide you off.
Right.
Who's the guide? You know? This is, you know what, I'm going to make a Frank's reference here, would you believe it? Bear with me on this.
No.
Trust me on this. I've got a good reason for it. You might recall in Darling in the Franks, there was The Beast and the Prince, the book that their own tale that they spun as kind of like an allegory for the future.
A book that she ate.
Yeah, it was delicious.
She ate the book.
So here's the thing, right, though.
Instead of reading it, she ate it.
Reader's Digest. But the point I'm making with that, though, is that... Yeah, I made that joke again. But the point I'm making with this is that... Like, when you bring up a tale, in a story, like I mentioned with Wrath of Khan, like, you know, Moby Dick and such like that, sometimes things play out allegorically to the actual story that you're referencing, be it, you know, an actual work of fiction or an in-universe work of fiction. And sometimes you play against time, like in Franks, and probably what's going to happen here in Banana Fish. Just because Ash has foreseen, like, or, you know, emphasized with the plight of that leopard, felt that he was going the same way, doesn't mean that's going to be true. After all, the leopard died alone. But obviously he's not alone anymore, is he? Because he has AG with him. So I think it's an interesting look here about how people could associate with, like, you know, fiction, how they can, you know, empathize with it, see themselves in it. Ultimately, you know, that the path that a work of fiction lays out for you and how you might, you know, link it to your own life, they're not set in stone. Life can go differently. And even when the way you see things happen, how they got there may be different. Ash obviously hasn't considered for a second that, you know, like in his two interpretations, that there are external forces that put him up there on this mountain, you know. Golzin in particular. He's literally been kept as a pet. So I thought that was a really interesting way to look at that.
Yeah, Ash doesn't really seem to think of himself as anything other than, well, I was going to say as anything other than free. I don't know. I mean, he clearly, he's racked with guilt and pain from all his trauma, but he's never sort of like, look at what happened to me. Like, I'm stuck, you know, I'm in this horrible spiral. So maybe that's why, like, you know, because he feels strong and he feels in control of his life now, maybe that's why he kind of identifies with the leopard and sees the leopard and doesn't consider that, like, oh yeah, clearly someone flew the leopard up there in a helicopter and plopped it down. It's like, no, it's a fucking leopard. It's majestic. It's king of its domain. And, like, if it's up there, it chose to be up there, or it chose to at least start down the path. You know, it's one thing if it crossed the point of no return. But yeah, I guess the leopard can't whine and cry about it, things being out of its own control. But what you just said is kind of the way the solution that Eiji points out, right? Doesn't he basically say that human agency is the solution to this problem?
Mm-hmm. I would argue so.
Humans, you know, unlike leopards, humans have the ability to change their destiny.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Which is interesting. Which is interesting, right? I mean, I feel like that point is a lot more valid if the leopard really did wander up there on its own. Because if the leopard was placed up there, then it's hard for me to hear, oh, you can change your destiny when, well, hey, guess what? The whole reason I'm up here on this mountain in the first place is because someone else changed my destiny. I didn't want to be up here.
Well, the thing is, that's just then you arriving at said mountain. It's not a question of what you do after it.
Yeah, but if...
And why should you say it's the other way?
But if there's a tone setting of you not being in control, you know what I mean? If this entire problem is framed and founded upon, hey, you know, your life is outside of your control, then it seems weird to say that the solution to the problem is take control. When the whole reason there's a problem
is
because you're not.
I wouldn't be so broad, because let's be quite honest here, Ash's life has been outside of his control. Mm-hmm. That is the truth of it.
Yeah.
So for me, like in this case, it does make sense that, you know, that's the interpretation you could roll with, because that's literally what's happened. It's just that he isn't factoring in the external forces. He's putting the blame, mostly on himself, even though I'd argue he has nothing to blame himself for. He's been caught, you know, in the worst kind of situation imaginable. So I think I understand where you're coming from broad terms, but specifically in this context, that I would argue is true.
But how free is Ash, really? I mean,
well,
at this point, you know,
well, that's a very, very broad question. I mean,
he's
like,
been shaped so heavily by these other things around him. You know what I mean? Well, I guess I'm just saying that, like, well, I mean, it is broad, but so is AG's solution. I mean, AG's solution to this leopard on Kilimanjaro issue is, hey, humans can change their destiny. humans can take control of their life and human agency. Like, you can will yourself off the mountain. You don't have to die up there.
Yeah.
But it's like, what if from birth, like, the leopard was raised in a snowy environment and, like, had all this
snow
horrible
leopard
shit happen to it and, like, grew to let, you know what I mean? So, like, Ash has been, is such a, he's his own person, but, like, he can't, like, you know, like, he's trying to tell AG, like, in some ways what he's telling him is true. Like, he can't really, like, escape kind of who he is based on, like, this really tumultuous and violent way he's lived his life.
Yeah. No, that's fair. I think it's going to be the idea of, you know, is Ash truly free is such a broad question. Like, is he even, like, you know, that's not even considering the idea of, you know, just captivity, but more like, he's, you know, is he free to change who he is? I mean, I mentioned in chat, leopards, you know, the old Ash can't change their spots. And that ties into the idea of, you know, the Better Two Worlds thing. Like, can he be a regular person? Can he live a regular life after having the very decidedly irregular life he's had thus far? We'll have to find out, of course. But yeah, I do absolutely think that the Kilimanjaro rabbit was the shining spot in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
I'll let you have your next talking point while I wind up to, you know, start saying horrible things about the show that I otherwise do rather like. I'm sorry, folks. I can only tell you as I see it, and I have to say, like, there were parts of this episode. Sorry.
You've been booed by the WAV file again. All right, here's my next point.
Next point.
Okay. More Kilimanjaro talk. It's interesting, in chat, you know, Trickster says that there is a primal drive to persevere apart from mere survival that can't be explained. The will to live, right? An organism's self-preservation instincts. It's interesting that that's brought up because during this discussion that AG and Ash had in the past that is being thought of by AG in this episode, Ash talks about, like you said, his thoughts of death, right? And he says, for me, like, he puts down this very fine line. Like, he says that the thought of death was sweetly tempting to him, right? Which is quite a loaded thing to say. Like, but toward the end of their talk, he reassures Eiji and says, you know, well, it's okay. I've thought about death, but I've never wished for it. So, boy, it's tempted you, but you've never wished for it. Like, I wonder if you parse it out, like, if that's contradictory at all, or, like,
or may
what,
I
what is
may I interject here?
Yeah, sure, sure.
Time to get a little personal, folks. That is not a contradiction, because I will freely admit that I have felt that way at times in my life. The way I would describe it is that it's something that, I mean, I actually saw someone about this, and they said to me, you know, you've thought about it, but you've not actually taken steps to do it. Can, you know, there's a difference between thinking about something and then actually acting to make it. So I don't think it's a contradiction at all. I think I can tell you from first-hand experience that, contradictory or no, I have felt that way.
And I see.
If I can think that way, I wouldn't presume, therefore, you know, other people in their own roots could not have felt similarly.
Yeah, so it would be the difference between thinking on the one hand, oh, if this outcome, my death, were to happen, that'd be fine, versus, okay, this is something I'm actively going to take steps to fulfill.
Yeah.
Okay. I see. So, yeah, it's very passive versus active. But, yeah, no, but, and I can see how, like, it would still be concerning, it being a temptation.
It's not, yeah, it's certainly not something that anyone should ever have to, be it deliberate for, or just because it pops into your head one day unbidden, like someone walking front door.
Mm-hmm.
No, absolutely. It should always be a concern, as it is here with Ash.
Yeah, I mean, this whole scene just got me thinking about David Foster Wallace's really famous what do you even call it? It's not a speech because the character's not speaking, but...
Essay?
No, but it's just part of Infinite Jest. It's just what a character in Infinite Jest is thinking, I think, when thinking about... So it's a character who's had suicidal...
In a monologue?
Maybe inner monologue, but just sort of their thoughts and, like... So, yeah, like, Ash is... So the way Ash is framing it, right, is that, like, you know, it's something that I can sort of, that I actively will decide that I can control going from temptation to wish, right? I've never wished for it. So, like, it feels like to me, maybe I'm, like, over-reading the situation. But Ash is sort of saying, like, you know, I've never transitioned from this one place to the other. And, you know, and then that's down to me, Ash, and my kind of stance on it or my willpower. It's just not a thing that I've pursued. But, like, Wallace, or Foster Wallace, like, talks about it really, really differently. Talks about it, like, less as like a sort of path that you choose to walk down, and like sort of after you sort of weigh the debits and credits of life, and then you're thinking, oh, life, like, it just doesn't seem to add up as a good thing. Like, I think I'm gonna go this way. Like, he talks about it as people. People gaining a people having a fear of living that's greater than a fear of falling. You know, because it's like, well, why do people jump, right? It's like, and he says, like, it's because that they feel the heat of the flames behind them, and that fire, of course, is life, and that fear, the fear of that is much greater than the fear of falling. And so just the way he frames it makes it seem like that it is something that's much, much less in someone's control. That it's not like...
I think...
You know what I mean? But whereas I feel like Ash... it feels like that he feels like that's entirely under his own power. Whereas...
I'll firstly just address the point by saying, like, I don't disagree with that gentleman's description or his interpretation of it. I think it's one of those things that's going to vary very differently between people who've lived those experiences. I personally would describe it as feeling like drowning. And then paradoxically, you want to come for air, even though the outcome is the exact opposite, of course. Speaking to Ash specifically, bear in mind that for much of his life, despite arguably having a lot of control and agency, like running a gang, for example, he also really hasn't. He hasn't had the basic agency or the basic liberties that a lot of people have. You know, if he wanted to say to Golzin one day, I'm done, I'm leaving, well, obviously Golzin's not going to let him. You know, he literally is a slave. He is a pet. So maybe the interpretation here is more that because he feels he can control it, it's one of the few things he does have genuine control over. He could, you know, call it quits, whatever he so chooses. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, normally, you know, for most people, having that choice, which is a choice everyone has, whether or not they even think about it, like, they don't think about it, so it's not a thing they consider. But when you have so little choice in your life, so little true choice, the ones that you do have left suddenly have more weight. So I think that maybe might be more what he's thinking about there, that, you know, like, I have so little ability to choose anything. Like, I at least treasure the fact that I can choose this. And if I have to exercise it to determine how I go, as opposed to, you know, how I, you know, get used and discarded by Golzin eventually, then I will. Which I think is perfectly admirable. Like,
yeah.
I can't truly, of course, ever say that I would do it in Ash's shoes, but I can certainly understand from his side things like, you know, like, if he literally had one chance one day just to, like, go out guns blazing in Golzin's mansion, and maybe not even kill the old fucker, but at least he got that act of defiance in. you know, right. before he did end up getting blown away, I think that would still be admirable. Utile, but admirable because he determined the time of which he went and the manner in which he went. It wasn't because Golzin one day said, right, well, fuck it, I'm boring, I'm going to go find a brunette kid instead. Bang, done. Puts him down like a dog.
Yeah,
I could see that happening.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, the ability to choose the manner in which you go, when you're in that scenario, you know, where you are being subjected to that, I think that's entirely understandable.
Yeah, I mean, you can find meaning in even horrible situations. Mm-hmm. You know, like you say, like the effectiveness of your choices is oftentimes so much less, it weighs so much less than you actually deciding and you making the choices.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
what you've chosen, less important than that you choose and that you stand, and that is sort of the meaning imbuing aspect of it.
Yeah.
For sure. I don't bring this up, but like I'm not trying to like slag off the show or Ash.
Oh no, I don't believe.
Okay. Yeah, no, it just got me thinking. More than anything, it got me feeling a deep sense of like just empathy and pain for people that have those feelings. You know, however, whether or not they are thinking that their life sucks so bad, you know, even if they were dead, it'd be fine, or if they're actively feeling the drowning or actively feeling that fear greater than the fear of falling, like it, you know, it just, it breaks my heart. Like I, for people suffering in those situations, like I just, I don't know. This sounds so fucking dumb, but I just wish they had someone to like, just grab them and hug them. Like,
and you mean like an agent? Them.
Yeah, exactly. Because I mean, because it just must feel so lonely.
Yeah. All right. So next talking point is time for me to, you know, bring the mood up or down depending on your perspective following that discussion. Not that I regret having it, of course. By talking about, well, let's talk about Arthur. Unfortunately, the sock puppet that is the most useless motherfucker who ever breathed oxygen in the banana fish universe. All right, I'm going to come out and say it. In the end, while I did enjoy Arthur getting his dues, he was not a good rival. He was a bit shit. And when I say that, I don't mean in terms of his effectiveness as a character. He could have failed throughout and still been the effective. I'm saying that I don't think overall in the wider scope of the story, he held a candle to any of the other major antagonists in terms of his relationship with that. Yeah, like, you know, constantly was busting Ash's balls and all that. But Ash only ever viewed him as like a roadblock or as a hump. There's no personal investment in hating Arthur. Like, not that I saw or interpreted. Arthur's effectiveness was also, I mean, I'd said, you know, it wasn't necessarily the case, but because there was no personal antagonism between the two, nothing that really tied them together, you know, the ties that bind us between these two rivals, what I had to fall back on then was just that he would be a compelling, intense threat. And no, absolutely not. The only time he ever felt like he was ever in control or in charge was when Ash was handed to him on a platter in the scenes in which, you know, we had Shaw's death, when he was literally at his mercy. At every other point, the show goes out of its way to make him look useless. To the point where I made a running joke of it. And here's the thing, right? I don't mind making a running joke because I really enjoyed it. I'm not going to, you know, pretend I didn't, you know, drink up that schadenfreude of seeing him get his dues over and over and having him continually dumped. So I thought it was great. But I actually think it does the show a disservice in the end, to be quite honest.
I can see that.
I think that, I mean, let me talk about the train scene very briefly. We talked about how this was a bit comical and all that. Okay. But here's the thing, right?
Just what you're saying makes me think of, and I promise this has to do with what you're saying.
I've done so many weird tangents throughout the course of Wari Desho that you're entitled to spend a few of your own, mate.
What you're saying makes me think of the sort of problem that major American wrestling promotion, WWE, has with writing bad guy characters, or heels, as they say in the biz.
In the biz.
So, Arthur, if this is Banana Fish were wrestling, Arthur would be pretty standard cowardly heel that can only win by cheating, by having some kind of advantage, you know, whether it's like using a foreign object or having another person interfere in the match against the good guy or babyface, again, as we say in the biz. And those kind of heel characters, like, their act can wear thin after a while, and it's hard for me personally as a fan when they are the kind of top bad guys, because when you see a wrestling show, you want to see decisively, in my opinion, like, the ultimate kind of goal is to see decisively who's better between the participants in the match. And whenever there's, like, shitty finishes, like, indecisive, whenever someone's winning by cheap means and cheating, it just doesn't feel satisfying. And Arthur, you never felt that he could beat Ash or best Ash on if things were on equal terms.
You know what's funny about that? Even when he's not cheating, that still in this episode, Ash gets shot through the arm, there's a fact in their late night fight.
He's that already was completely, at a disadvantage.
But that's the thing, like, that was not something that Arthur intended to happen. I mean, like, if anyone said to me Arthur deliberately let his men get slaughtered just so he could soften him up so he could have a fight with him, I wouldn't buy that for a moment. He's not that smart. But even when he's not doing that, it still puts Ash at a disadvantage. And this is the thing, like, I don't know if this is the fault of Ash just being too good or Arthur being too bad or a combination thereof. Well, I can only speak to my feelings on this. And when the train scene was happening, which Ash was inexplicably mowing his way through all of those guys with barely any trouble, I didn't feel any tension for what was going to happen. I didn't feel any tension about the coming fight between him and Arthur. Mm-hmm. It should have felt like, I mean, the visual metaphor is clear as crystal. It's the end of the line when they go off that train. It's so on the nose, but if it fits. I'm not disputing that. But I didn't feel like this was ever in doubt. I mean, okay, you can always speak to the fact that, yes, of course, Ash is going to win the fight. Although, that being said, imagine an alternate version of Banana Fish where he dies here and AG's the one who has to take over his role as gang leader. What a thing that would have fucking been. Holy shit. Man. Okay, anyway, I'm not going to think about it. even when you know that's going to happen, because, I mean, you know how all these things go in movies. We're all savvy enough to understand that. You should at least still feel an air of tension about it. And I didn't. I was laughing at the fight, at the gunfight in the train scene, and I don't get the impression I should have been. But the problem is that there's also no real personal interplay. Like, to me, the fight between, like, the long-standing rivalry between Ash and Arthur only ever really felt to me like fucking Red and Gary Oak. That's the level at which this reached. Ah. And the thing is, right, there's plenty of reason why Ash would have to hate Arthur that he never, I don't think to my memory, voices, even though I can see it happening, which is the fact that Arthur has the freedom that he does not. He is Galzine's, you know, underling, much as Ash is. But Arthur, you know, firstly isn't, you know, used as a fuck doll. At least not to my knowledge. So there's that. Like, there's plenty of reason, but, you know, for that, you know, resentment to exist on Ash's side. As for Arthur, I mean, obviously, you know, Ash is great at everything and all that. That's fine. It never felt that strong to me. Like, we didn't get enough emotion or anger out of him at the end. Like you said, I've always hated you from my soul. Like, that's it. Mm. No screaming or shouting.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't. It didn't really work for me, to be honest. Arthur as a character. I mean, he works when I took him ironically and not really seriously. But I also don't think that was the work's intent.
悪いでしょう.
Hello, I'm so sorry about that extended break, everybody. Oh, are you here, Shadon?
I'm here. Yes.
There you go.
Hey.
Hello.
Were you just fighting off an invasion by lizard people?
Yeah.
How many lizard men did you kill, Doc?
So many lizard men. There was a serious conversation with a colleague that was taking place, and
on how to dispose of the lizard men bodies.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we chose a ceremonial cremation for each one. No, it just kind of went places, and yeah, I'm sorry about that. Everybody.
Shy happens, don't worry about it, mate. Do not worry. I've been keeping the fire warm by talking Yuri and Ice with the chat for a bit, and also discussing some various bits. Alright, I'll quickly just tail off on the point I was making about Arv, which is that, speaking for myself here, I don't think he was fleshed out enough, either in terms of his personal rivalry. I mean, I understood why he hated Ash, like he's obviously very jealous, but I wanted him to articulate it. Not even necessarily to anyone else, just to himself. I mean, we had that scene at the start of this episode where he was obviously thinking and looking at things. But that was an event that happened when he already didn't like him. Like, you know, I wanted some more concrete terms here. It didn't need to be completely and utterly, you know, like, laid out bare bones in, like, a giant dissertation. Like, bullet points, PowerPoint, everything as to why he hated him. But I wanted more than what we got. It felt insufficient to me. That being said, I'm also very grateful he's not the main antagonist, and that's why I said before that his narrative purpose is now served. He is done. So now we've got, of course, have to deal with the other more interesting characters who will be saved for the finale and such, which I'm still very much looking forward to.
Yes. So, Arthur. I have complicated feelings about Arthur. Yeah, no, I mean, like I was saying, like, he's, like... I wish he could have felt that... He could have at least stood a chance, somewhat of a chance against Ash,
mm-hmm.
on fair footing.
Yeah.
You know, that yeah. he was, like, the scene on the train, right, in which Ash is trapped in the middle car. Instead of just going and shooting Ash himself, like, Ash is a fucking sitting duck. He's totally trapped. He's, like, shoving people out the door. You do it. You do it. You do it. And, like, you know, I know he's, like, dastardly and a fucking dick and everything, but I don't know. Don't you want to gain the respect of your guys at a certain point?
Yeah. I mean, maybe he was just going easy because he obviously didn't use Zalardo on him. So there's that.
So how did you feel about... Let's talk more. Hang on. Where is the button? Okay, there's my mouse.
Next point.
We got to make a poll as well. Was Arthur a well-written villain, or was he just genuinely fucking useless?
We should. Yeah, right.
We should.
I'll make that. But how did you... So you talked about, like, Ash's kind of nobility or whatever. His deal at the end when he says, no, I'm not going to put a bullet in your brain. We're going to have this fucking duel honorably or whatever. Like, boy, that just felt so fucking strange.
It was utterly perfunctory to me. Like, here's the thing, right? This is now the 13th episode of the show. So establishing that Ash, you know, has good sensibilities and a sense of honor and ethics and code or whatever, we already know. We don't need to have that reinforced anymore. Furthermore, there's nothing riding on him doing that. No one is, like, I can't imagine Cain, for example, going like, well, after all that shit, you still shouldn't have shot him dead at the end. Like, no. I can't fathom that happening from anyone. If he had just blown Arthur away at the end then, and everyone like, well, fair enough. He didn't play fair. No reason for you. Sue's do the same. So I don't know what the narrative function of Ash, you know, going easy on him serves.
Yeah.
Because it's either redundant, because it tells us what we already know about him, or B, it's just there more to sell the action scene, which is fine and all that. I'm okay with that. And maybe, you know, you can make the argument that just having him shoot him dead would be unsatisfying. It's like, oh, well, that's it. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, but what happened to all the pent up, like, Arthur, I'm gonna fucking kill you for making me kill shorter. Like,
actually, that's a very good point.
Where is this, like, Arthur, I'm gonna turn this into a teachable moment.
This is why you just hit the nail on the head there for me. This is why this doesn't feel like as good a rivalry as it could do, because it's not nearly personal enough, despite the fact that there's more enough reasoning on both sides for it to be personal, especially in events that have happened since then. Shorter's name is not even mentioned. That's kind of a baffling and glaring omission to me, that's not some... Holy shit, that's a problem.
I mean, AG's the only one that talks about it in the flashback, you know? It's like, why are you so... Like, I wish I knew what you were having nightmares about.
Why is... I mean, Trickster's just brought the Doctor. And the thing is, when Ash killed the Doctor, he was still trying to shoot him dead after he ran out of ammo.
Yeah, where's that gone?
We discussed this in the previous episodes. Yeah, we discussed this on previous episodes where you're like, obviously he wanted to do more harm to him, but couldn't. And obviously whatever harm he did would have been enough. With Arthur, he's just like, I don't know. I don't know what to make of that.
I mean, it's like you felt some kind of guilt whenever, like, the whole reason Arthur got his fingers fucked up is because he was a coward in the first place. Like, I thought,
didn't Ash execute that guy in the back alley who was unarmed anyway? So if you're going to tell me he wouldn't do that, he has done that.
He also executed someone on the train. That was some fucking heartless shit. And now we're supposed to think, like, I mean, I know he's got the dual nature, right? Of, like, the sort of fragile boy, like, hidden beneath these layers built up into, like, a wounded tiger, they say, you know, a devil. But, like, man, it's just tough because, like, there's this quivering boy trying to pick up his Uzi and, like, Ash just shoots him in the head. You know what I mean? But then he's like, Arthur, it's time we settled this fair and square because you need to, like... I felt like it was for Arthur. Like, he was doing it for Arthur. Why?
Why?
What does Ash have to gain?
He gave him the gun that he used to shoot Shorter dead, as far as I'm concerned. It would have actually... The only reason he shouldn't have shot him was so he could have thrown him off the train and have him just become a skid mark.
Like, and so Miss KR brings up the pre-series stuff with Arthur. And so I was thinking the whole time, like, because I feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but like that visually they've depicted Ash having some guilt for what he's done to Arthur. But we see it happen in the flashback and Arthur completely deserved it. Arthur tried to kill him, like, from behind after losing fair and square to him. And so then Ash fucked his fingers up to protect himself. Like, I don't know. I just, yeah, it just didn't feel... It didn't feel
great.
And it made the whole, why would Ash systematically march through all of Arthur's men, killing them without... off, you know, without any sort of...
Arthur here. Yeah.
Take this weapon and let's have a fair fight.
You know, Lucy's just brought up a point. In fiction, when you want to make a character look great, there are two ways you can do this. The first is that you genuinely make the character competent, but hopefully not hyper-competent. But the problem is that when you do that, and you do that too much, when the character is so good, you can't actually really then start, you know, making them any better than that point. Like, you get diminishing returns on it. How then do you compensate for that? You make other people look worse. So, Lucy is entirely on the nose there with assessing that Arthur is bad because he, not because he of any genuine character reason, but because it makes Ash look better, which is crying shame. There's one other thing I want to segue onto here, which is to talk about camera...
As far as him as an effective villain, I mean...
No.
Well, this is something that, you know, you learn, you know, pretty young if you read a lot of fiction. I mean, I remember, I think my first encounter with this was Magneto from X-Men when I was reading those comics as a kid. Like, the best villains...
Welcome to die!
The best villains always kind of have a point, right?
Yeah.
Maybe not all the way, but a little bit. But, like,
Arthur... The thing is, you should understand their logic and their reasoning for it. You should like, you say, I understand, but I do not agree. That's the dividing line there. You can see how it makes sense then. I mean, in Magneto's case, the example he brought, of course he would think that way, that, you know, the mutant's going to be wiped out, because guess what? He was born Jewish, and he saw his parents taken to the fucking Nazi concentration camp. Of course it's burned into his memory, and he sees the analogy between them. And this is what I was saying before about Arthur. He has his reasons, but they weren't ever articulated with enough emotion or personal venom to me to truly make me buy into it.
Yeah.
It wasn't enough. It was insufficient.
Yeah, it never rose above, like, I hate you and I'm jealous of your spot. Like, occasionally it would get to, like, near the end, I think it actually articulated, you know, the reason that I hate you is because you are gifted and you never have to work for anything that you got, and you don't want it, or you're ambivalent about it, and I resent you for that. Because I've worked so hard for everything, but there's so much I can't attain because I don't have your natural talent. And that kind of resentment. I don't feel like that was capitalized on enough in the story.
We weren't really shown enough of it either, to be honest. I mean, not certainly not this moment. And on top of that, I'm sorry, very sorry to say, Arthur, but for all that you might want to say that Ash gets stuff laid hand on feet for him, there is a caveat to that, a very significant one, that you five-finger discounting bastard, don't have to suffer. So shut your mouth.
Yeah.
Honestly.
He never had to sacrifice anything. Please. Like, please.
I mean, woo. To be fair, Arthur at least is consistent even in this final moments of being... complete stone dead idiot. There is one thing I very quickly want to segue on as well, which is talking about the train scene and why else this did. And I'm going to tie this to the Kilimanjaro bit. So, okay, we've had a running theme throughout the show now of the idea of Ash being an animal, being described as one both as a lynx and all that, you know, pet, but also the idea of, you know, him going feral because of everything that's happened to him, you know, him going on those killing sprees. And here's the thing, they were this close to turning the train car comedy, you know, Naked Gun shit into something that actually gelled with the idea of him being an animal. Because recall the stuff that happened in the mansion when he killed the doctor, when he was portrayed against fire, you know, literally burning in it, you know, being forged into something cruel and twisted. There's nothing here, direction-wise, camera-wise, colour-wise, sound-wise, with what happens with the car, the fight scenes in the train, that help reinforce that, even though if they had done it, it would have gelled perfectly with the whole leopard thing, you know, searching for prey, going, because he's literally going down a car, he's going in one direction to it. Like, you could have done it with that. You could have. Man. That whole thing was so frustrating. It was so cool. It could have been changed to be great. But that, I think, is one of the few instances, rare instances even, I would say this show is actually... been uninspired in its direction and its and the way it looks and the way, you know, uses camera and such. Honestly, I like this show, I really do, but at the same time, this episode is probably the worst one I've seen thus far of the lot. But that being said, it also comes with a, you know, a reassurance that we're not going to have to deal with Arthur anymore, so we'll now get back onto the good stuff. Give me more Logan.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I was thinking, like, this episode, maybe more than even the last time this happened, sort of showed me what I really like about this show, and that is the interpersonal character
drama,
stuff.
Yeah.
And but the reason that it feels unique, though, is because it's built on top of this foundation of crime and violence. So you gotta have that, and don't get me wrong, like I like that stuff. I even, you know, on a certain sort of visceral level, enjoyed the Nathan Drake type stuff, like as it was presented. So yeah, I mean, I may agree that it's one of the least good Banana Fish episodes, but by that criteria, it makes it still a a pretty darn good half hour of television.
For sure. And like I say, like, even despite the fact it wasn't as effective as I'd have liked, and in the end I did realise, you know, in hindsight, that Arthur was, well, rubbish, narratively, mechanically. Like, I'm not going to pretend that I didn't have a good laugh and didn't have a good, you know, time seeing him fail and seeing him, you know, put down in the end. That was cathartic. The payoff was good. My complaint is that it could have been so much better, especially when you consider, when you consider how good the other material is. The fact that, like, that's one of the things that often maddens me about shows. Like, if I have a show that's consistently terrible throughout, then I, you know, I actually somehow paradoxically get less annoyed at it, because at least I can come to expect that. And you have a moment slice where it's like, oh, I've seen so much better things here with, like, camera, direction, lighting, you know, an actual narrative, and this is just kind of, well, he's just going to gun down these fuckers down in, you know, train, and it's fine. And I'm like, okay, great. What ultimately does Ash killing all these people in the train accomplish, other than addressing the fact that there were people on the train? Does it tell us anything about his character? Does it reinforce the notions we've had before about him, you know, going wild, you know, becoming a mass murderer, becoming bloodthirsty? You could make the argument, perhaps, that, you know, that he doesn't react to anything, you know, while he's going on this, but the thing is, the camera does not back that up, whereas we had visual cues to show that in the incident at the mansion. There was no such thing this time around. It was very utilitarian. So, I don't know.
I
really hate to come down the show like this, but I can only speak to how I feel on it.
Do you not think that it reinforced the notion of Ash as sort of legendary gunman figure?
No, because at the end of the day, there, I don't care how good a gunman you are, I don't care if you're Revolver Ocelot. He shouldn't have survived that. He shouldn't have survived the scenario.
There was a point where, like, and I know sometimes the animation isn't matching kind of real time, but it looked like Ash slid into the middle of the aisle and shot someone, and while he was, like, in the middle of the floor, there was just so much time for him to get shot in the back of the head.
I know. Mirrors just made a good point, actually. Like, when you translate something from book or manga to TV, you have to put a lot more definitive connective tissue in how scenes play out. Like, if I, for example, were, say, to, you know, show, let's say, a frame of Ash firing and then a shot, like, you know, of several guys dead, I have to then mentally interpret the passage of time and fill in the blanks myself.
Exactly.
And usually I'll probably do that in a way that feels fitting for me. Like, you know, I'll imagine in much detail as little detail as I wish.
Yeah,
whereas on screen,
the pace of the events.
Yeah. Whereas on screen, that has to be dictated. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not to say you have to show every nitty gritty detail. Emily is correct, actually. believe me, I've been there. I have been there. That is so true. It's not even
That's good.
Funny.
That's good.
And not, no, you know what? You know, I'm going to just follow up Emily's comment there by saying, if that was the case, that the train was coming in with all that Arthur's goons on it, it would be 10 minutes late or longer, and therefore, like, Arthur, like, wait, I want to hold the fight. I want to postpone the fight just a little bit. It's like, why? No reason. Honestly, I swear, no reason.
Before we fight with knives, let us fight with riddles. Solve this puzzle.
1, 2, 3, 4. I declare a form war.
Yep. Yeah, we have.
And actually, Arthur can't do that. He can't do that.
How dare you? How dare you? So disrespectful.
Oh, fuck that guy. I don't care. I didn't mean that. But sometimes, you know, great moments just happen. Anyway, that's pretty much everything I want to say on the episode as a whole, to be quite honest.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I could keep talking about this for ages, but I'd probably just keep repeating myself or kind of dancing around the same points. I am frustrated. I am a little frustrated because, gosh, this show was like, it was just barreling along this path of, like, complete.
And then you might say it derailed a little bit.
Right. Changed lanes, changed tracks. But, like,
I mean, to be fair, it is giving me some mixed signals.
God, please stop. Fuck, man, you've derailed me. it was just giving me what I want, right? And enlarge, basically, like the whole way through was just like, man, this is great, it's great, it's great. And I feel like here is, for me, the first kind of episode I've come away with really feeling like there was a big plot point that I just wasn't satisfied with the way that they stuck the landing with it.
Yeah.
The build-up was so good. Like,
From the shorter stuff
to him parting with AG to, like, you know, Rumble one-on-one, like, all the everything in between. You know, I just wanted this confrontation to... I just wanted it to be better. It just was not as good as it could have been.
I think, and for me, like...
Maybe that's how Arthur's sucking.
Yeah. I think, for me, it comes down to two things. One, I think this episode actually, through the benefit of hindsight, made me realize that Arthur was never working in the first place as a character. I mean, I don't think that the... I don't think he was meant to be taken as a joke. But the problem is that you can look at my Twitter for the amount of times I've dumped on him. I did take him as a joke. And yeah, that's fun. That's fun to do. But here's the thing. If I set out to do serious drama and I don't do serious drama, I have failed. So if I'm setting out to make a character who is a rival, who is meant to be taken seriously, and I turn people don't take him seriously, that is a failure. Right. It's as simple as that.
Sure.
I'm sorry. However, unlike previous shows, like the one I mentioned earlier, the little show that fucking couldn't, one, I have a lot more faith in Banana Fish for a couple of reasons. Mm-hmm. Firstly, the rest of the material is still solid. The Kilimanjaro bit with that little discussion, you know, about the leopard was excellent. That was great. That was fantastic. That was great. Two, this is the ending of a plot. Mm-hmm. Arthur is now done. He is spent as a character. He will not... I can't see him coming back because I can't see what purpose he would serve. So that's great. I'm okay with that. I'm not worried about the show's future because of the fact that he's no longer a factor. We're going to have the interesting characters come in there. Yulung, Yulung will make a return. Yulung will come back. Yeah, exactly. He'll be back. So, as much as this episode was regrettably a relative disappointment, mm-hmm. it's still solid. It still felt good to see that finally happen between Ash and Arthur. Again, my complaint is more that I just wish it was better handled, but mm-hmm. whatever. And I'm still excited to see what happens next. So bring it on, I say. More please, and good rinse to bad rubbish in Arthur, you know, Mr. Five Finger Discount himself.
Jeez. Alright, we have to make an Arthur poll. Alright. So are you glad he's gone? 3 question marks.
Oh, to answer your question, Mira. I'm going to say that Goldstein is not going to return until probably the later part of the show. This is where Yuslong will make his move. I think that the rest of the shows will be clearly or cleanly segmented into dealing with him and then Goldstein second. As for what's going to happen with him, well, with Arthur out of the picture and him being, of course, in command of Goldstein's men, this leaves a power vacuum. Because Goldstein, of course, is out of the country and he probably doesn't have Skype or Discord, so he can't instruct his men to do shit. So I'm reckoning this is going to cause the Chinese to flare up. Characters, of course, are caught in prison, so they're going to have to get out of it somehow. I'm hoping we don't get a full... I will say this. We had the prison stuff previously. I don't want another full episode or two devoted to time in prison. I would be very happy if the next episode started, or nearly started, with Ash coming out, like, you know, straight out of it. In, mm-hmm. out. And the time in between isn't relevant. Because it doesn't matter. We don't need to bog it down at this point. Let's keep things going. Let's deal with the fallout of this. And let's have, you know, Mr. Dark Side of the Moon himself, you know, come into play.
Mr. Dark Side of the Moon, right.
Yeah. I am, however, going to say that I am surprised Arthur didn't actually live as long, come to think of it, in the end. But that being said, with the now realization I've had of how rubbish he was, for the show and the material, well, again, Quickprints are bad rubbish on many levels.
What's the over-under for plane tickets booked for AG that he just doesn't use in this show? How many have there been thus far?
I don't even know. I don't even know.
Oh, man. How many tickets booked for AG will go unused?
Well, at least we get that GoFundMe going in a bit. Crowdfund this trip home. Or maybe they'll use eBay's Patreon dollars, I don't know.
eBay's Patreon dollars, how dare you.
Still my favorite running joke.
Oh my god. Alright, Shadon, if you had to rate the episode then, what would you, in your critical, you know, stance on it, where does that come out numerically?
Alright. Please forgive me, folks, for what I am about to do.
On a 5-point scale.
Right. Please forgive me for what I am about to do. But again, I can only speak to how I rate it. I'd rather be honest with you guys rather than say, you know, pretend that this work is absolutely flawless. Like, what do we benefit from, you know, pretending otherwise when I can only speak to my reaction was that I was laughing during the train section and I shouldn't have been. I mean, come on. The train section was not meant to be a joke. But I was just pissing myself with laughter. It was, as you said, Nathan Drake level stuff. But hey. So, in the end,
Is he still chilling with Max? Is that where he is?
He's back in Japan now, and he's just like, shit, have I forgotten something? Did I leave something behind? I should probably go check with the airline.
I don't know. He's either like in Japan or with Max still. They haven't shown him leaving, but. Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway,
all right. Give it to me straight.
For me, final score will be 2.5. Yeah, you heard me. 2.5 subway drive-bys out of 5.
Wow. That's really low.
It is.
That's
I've explained why, because I genuinely felt like I genuinely felt like, apart from the Kilimanjaro stuff, the rest of this just felt like Arthur went out with a whimper rather than a bang. That explains pretty much everything else that happened up until that point. It was just ineffectual. I'm sorry, guys. That's the truth of how I feel about it. It wasn't up to stuff.
No. Gosh. Well, you know. I'm gonna rate it 3.5 graffiti covered trains out of 5. well, no, you did the train, so I'll say
aha
3.5.
You need to train harder.
3.5 replaced fingers out of 5. 3.5 sweet ass MK2 fatalities out of 5. man. Wow, 2.5. Boy. Man, I don't know. I really, like I said, I think we both enjoyed the middle quite a lot. And, you know, despite the dissatisfaction I felt with the scenes I was unsatisfied with, I don't know. I mean, it was still Ash, and he was doing cool things, which, again, on a certain level, a base level, I appreciated.
I will just mention one thing with regards to making Ash do cool things, though, that's problematic. In that, much as it defanged attention for the trade stuff, it's also now going to factor in what happens later. Now, that being said, Lut is not Arthur. Arthur was mostly about fighting strictly with brute force. You know, I'll throw gang members at him, it'll be fine. Oh, I'll try and fight him one-on-one, it'll be fine. And obviously, he lost every time. Whereas Yolong, of course, is more of a schemer, and that's where the interesting stuff happens. So, that's fine and all, but, like, insofar as actual physical altercations go, like, I don't have much fear for Ash at this point.
Yeah.
And again, like, as I said before...
Okay, so I think, like, this is why Yolong will be more interesting. Because I predict that he'll... that the fight will be more about manipulating Ash into these various situations, you know? That he can't get out of, or it's extremely difficult for him to get out of.
Yeah, I hear you on that. I mean, funnily enough, I recently started watching Thunderbolt Fantasy Season 2. And here's the thing, right? There are two concurrently running plots in that show thus far, one of which is about Shang and, you know, his, you know, unlimited Blade Works imitation scroll thing. And then, of course, there's Mr. Enigmatic Gale, Mr. Vape Wizard Gui Nao, and I can't remember the gentleman's name who was from Seiyu. He's the guy with the glasses. Now, here's the thing, right? All of the action thus far has been with Shang fighting the Princess of Cruelty Lady, Shay, or whatever the name is. I'm so sorry. I'm terrible with Chinese-Japanese names.
I was going to say, like, you don't even get Japanese names.
No, I can't even get any of them right. I'm terrible. I'm absolutely terrible.
I mean, we, like, don't they?
We're probably a bad podcast, so of course we, of course we are. We're on brand. We're on brand for getting it wrong. We're Dirty Gaijin, or Gaijin, I suppose you want to call it. Like, you want to really muck it up. But the point I was trying to make was that all of the action in that show thus far has been centered around Shang fighting, you know, the Princess Cruelty Lady, which is good, don't get me wrong. But for me, the best bits by far have been watching Mr. Vape Wizard, you know, stirring and mixing shit up. He's not fighting anyone. He's just literally talking, having banter with this guy from Seiyu, who's trying to, you know, do his own thing of lies and deception. So that's why I'm hopeful that that will similarly follow here. We've got, you know, Mr. Dark Side of the Moon himself, you know, mixing things up. Now that we've got, like, the Disc 1 final boss out of the way.
The Disc 1. Oh, he's not even a Disc 2 final boss.
Of course he is. Hell, I'm surprised. I'm surprised I barely consider him, you know, more than the final boss in Midgar in Final Fantasy VII, the one you fight on the, you know, the motorway.
Yeah.
He's barely that. Anyway.
That's an easy boss. Most bosses in that game are, to be fair. But
Lost Number was a bitch, though. But anyway,
oh my
that's
god! No, yeah, no. There's some
Kariyama. Kariyama. Oh my god, Kariyama was just a. Anyway, we'll cut the discussion on the Archie Shark. So yes, that's episode 13 of Banana Fish, the Snows of Kilimanjaro. And why? Yes, I was a bit frosty on this episode, but thank you always, everyone, for listening and joining in with us today, both in chat and just in the stream in general. Always a pleasure to be here. Good to have you guys back here after the break that we had recently.
Yes, always enjoy hanging out.
Indeed, yeah, it's always good to have you here. Mira, by the way, asked before about checking out the manga. I'm going to consider doing that once the show is actually concluded, just so I can see it. Because I did buy I bought all the volumes that are in English that I can get hold of as far for Land of the Lustrous. And I feel, you know, I'd be remiss not to start with Banana Fish. But anyway, Doc, so assuming someone finds themselves on the internet for some strange and terrifying reason, where can people find you?
At The Subtle Doctor on Twitter.
Good stuff. As for me, well, you know, whether I'm playing fighting games, talking about anime, you know, decrying the state of my life, all the sorts of crazy shit that I get up to, you can find me at Shade and Tencent and Ever Curious Cat on the same handle as well if you feel like sending pointed or non-pointed questions. So there you go. Anyway, that concludes that. We'll be back next week with episode 14 when hopefully, you know, things pick up. Still loving the show, of course. It's just, well, you know, I mean, it's rare that you have a show that's consistently perfect. There's always going to be some episodes that are weak and others, and it's a relative. But from me and Doc, as always, thank you all, everyone, so much for listening. Have a very pleasant evening. And as always, everyone, brace yourself to the ends of the universe. Au revoir.